dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Government as a tool of wealthy and powerful interests is nothing new. Rather, it is the primary reason that governments exist. If you don't believe that, consider this simple fact. Corporations and plutocrats have caused the death and immiseration of millions of people. Yet how many CEOs are there on death row or in the burgeoning prisons of America? Law enforcement agencies have most often been used against political dissidents. And as we will hear tonight, the FBI was created to suppress radical movements that challenge the plutocracy. And nothing has changed. Tonight, we will devote most of the program to a talk by activist and scholar Ward Churchill on the history of political repression against movements of equality and equity in the United States. Then, a report on a miners' strike in Ontario, where we can see, in a current context, the same historical dynamics that Churchill discusses, and also what it takes to defeat this unholy alliance of corporate and state power. And to close, the facts behind that swindle called electricity deregulation.
Darkness and midnight, when the pot-bellied beast chase their unwelcome guests.
The following lecture by Ward Churchill was recorded last week in Washington, D.C. at the National Conference on Organized Resistance. We apologize for the poor sound quality. This talk was too important to miss, so we've cleaned it up as best we can.
Currently, he's a professor in the Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's published extensively on indigenous rights issues, political repression, and the politics of imprisonment. And here's Ward.
Hey. CEO, Osiju. Hello, my relatives. Good to see you here. I'm not going to repeat everything that was said to begin yesterday, but I'm going to take the same approach that was taken in the pacifism pathology workshop. I'm not sure how talking heads fit into workshops, but that seems to be the format, and so we'll proceed with it. What I'm going to try to do is give an overview of the subject matter, the way Vanderwall and I presented it, Donner and Goldstein and few other people have presented it, just to set some parameters on it. Convert as much time as possible into interaction and interchange, because there's going to be big holes. There's way, way too much detail that's involved in this. The FBI's been very busy, okay? So there's no way we're going to get to all of it in the presentation part. If I even attempted to, that would take up all of the time. So we won't do that. But I'm going to try to lay out the history, some of the techniques, some of the commonalities that run through the thing. Chip Berlay will be taking it up to current in the next workshop, as is already mentioned. I encourage everyone to go to that because it's more like current events. But current events can only be understood in terms of their historical legs. This stuff is not new. And there's ways that it needs to be looked at in order to counter it effective. Counterintelligence, perhaps. But to begin with, I suppose, was a statement that was made yesterday, is that infiltration of organizations is some kind of an all-time high, so let's just tag it right there and back up. No, it's not. No, it's not. There was a point coming into the 1960s when the Socialist Workers' Party was composed one-third of FBI personnel. We used to have a joke during the 60s about you could always tell who the FBI agents were in the Communist Party by the fact that they were paying dues. Had they not, the organization would have been totally defunct. It was 50% and upwards of the total CP membership were either active agent personnel or people who had been retained one way or another to provide information to the FBI. And we're talking a third of a century ago, but let's back it up to where this actually all begins, and you have to have an inset date, that's the way the Bureau would refer to it, of about 1852 with the foundation of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, because that's the precursor to the FBI. Ronald Reagan didn't invent privatization. The idea at the time of the Civil War in the United States, when they didn't even have a Justice Department yet, they were in the process of forming that, was that they would farm out the investigative activity of the federal government to the private sector, that there were people with the competencies and the expertise out there that could be a cost-cutting or a savings measure for the central government if they did not have to establish their own. The Pinkertons, as you probably know, and if you don't, I'm about to inform you, its bread and butter was working for major corporate interests in the society, primarily the railroads and the steel corporations, not exclusively so, but that's where their bread and butter was. And so from the very inception of this whole thing, you've got this unholy interlock between private sector police accountable to no one other than their paymasters, corporate interests in the federal government. That triangle has existed since the moment this stuff began. And the operational techniques and the priorities that accrue from that have been present since before the FBI as such, even before the Bureau of Investigation, which is the federal precursor of the FBI, ever came into existence. You got a half century of operational reality here. And on the one hand, the Pinkertons are best known for mounting private armies that work for the corporations to suppress strikers and so forth, but on the other hand, they had an active counterintelligence profile that was in some ways more effective than the mounting of the armies themselves. And let me give you a couple of examples of how this stuff is formed by the Pinkertons and then carried on into politically repressive activities in the second half of the 20th century. The way the Pinkertons get on the board, for example, is to conjure up the idea that there is a secessionist plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln before he even takes office. He's on a train coming over for the inauguration. Alan Pinkerton, who is the founder of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, goes to the federal government and says, I've uncovered this secessionist plot. A bunch of Southerners, pro-slavery people, who are going to assassinate the president-elect. And they said, well, what do we do about it? And he says, I can handle it. And Lincoln was not assassinated, and therefore it was a successful operation. There is no evidence at all that such a plot existed. Thing one was done by the Pinkerton Detective Agency to avert an assassination. They simply announced it as a fact based on confidential sources that no one could know about, because if you reveal the nature of the sources, you would render them inoperative. Then the event that was predicted didn't happen, and that's attributed as being a success. So you can conjure up these criminal conspiracies of political activists. What will be received in the body politic is a criminal conspiracy, and you can prevent it from functioning, or so you say, take credit for it, and further your interest in your luster and your reputation, in this case, become the primary investigative entity for the federal government itself. Now let me tie that to something in the 20th century. Daniel and Philip Berrigan, terrorist Catholic clergy, okay, were dragged into court in the late 1960s, early 70s actually, I think it was 71, on a plot to assassinate Henry Kissinger by blowing up the tunnels in Washington, D.C. with aerosol spray cans. All right? This is Looney Tunes. It's laughable, except that these guys were facing 40 years on criminal conspiracy charges for taking out government officials, to wit Kissinger. There is no evidence at all that the FBI has ever produced that this was even discussed. It was simply a group of infiltrator provocateurs working for the FBI who reported this to be a fact. No corroborating information at all. And you got a number one sensationalist press campaign that could be mounted off the back of this in order to convince the general public of the United States that there is a terrorist conspiracy that warrants extraordinarily draconian responses by the federal government in the name of public order, okay? And an accomplishment for the Bureau that it can hang its hat on, that it can increase its public luster on, that it's invented out of whole cloth. Pinkerton technique in 1861, FBI technique 1971, 110 years difference, exactly the same thing, except they're more effective at it in 1971, of course, because you got a more effective media apparatus out there, and the technique has been refined to a considerable extent. That's how they come on the boards. Anybody out there ever heard of the James Younger gang in Missouri? Anybody seen the Long Riders? You heard of Jesse James? That was a Pinkerton operation in behalf of the railroads and the government of the state of Missouri, and ultimately for the United States government, because the laying of track rail lines as part of the industrial infrastructure of the United States is actually an official program of the U.S. to further the interests of the robber barons who are building the railroads, because it furthers the interests of the United States, not only in economic terms, but in strategic terms, to have rapid transit, all right? Now, they had a rough time with the James boys, the Youngers too, for that matter, partly because the citizenry of southern Missouri wasn't really fond of having these fat cats come in and impound their land, dispossessed, and push them off their property in order to lay railroad tracks through the area for some abstract notion of the greater good, whose interests really coincided with the people who were doing it to them, and they understood that much better than the average Americans did. And so when the James boys responded by robbing trains, they weren't the first. There's a whole another operation we could talk about in Indiana with the Reno gang and how the Pinkertons took care of them. But let's stick with this one, because there's some continuity into the 20th century with it. The upshot of that is that those guys were pretty popular in southern Missouri. And the upshot of that upshot was that the Pinkertons were spectacularly unsuccessful in being able to apprehend the James Younger group. So how did they resolve the problem? What was this success, the method that was used to accomplish the neutralization, as they would later call it, of the James gang? They hired an infiltrator to go in and blow the back of Jesse James' head off in his own parlor. Case closed. So what you've got, if it was in an overtly political context, is an assassination that just occurred, and they still celebrate in that one. Okay, let's pull this up to the 4th of December, 1969. Fred Hampton, narcotized, asleep, unconscious in his apartment, a raider team coordinated by the FBI, but composed of special squad of state's attorney's police in Chicago, Illinois, comes into Hampton's apartment with a map prepared for them, floor plan that's prepared for them by an FBI infiltrator by the name of William O'Neill, with an X marked on the location of Hampton's bed so that one of the guys could stand in the next room and fire a Thompson submachine gun the full length of the wall into Hampton's bed to neutralize a Black Panther Party leader of extraordinary importance in the assessment of the FBI, and coincidentally in the assessment of everybody else as well. Why did they assassinate Fred Hampton? Because they tried to take him out by other means, and they had not been successful in doing so. They'd attempted to discredit him, they'd attempted to put him in prison, they'd attempted several things to take him out of action. Hadn't worked, so they killed him. Exactly the same thing in principle as it was done by the Pinkertons in terms of solving, put quotes around that, the James Younger case. Jesse James was the last of the leadership of that gang, as they called it, as they call us from time to time, okay, to take them out of action to be able to close the books on it. Pennsylvania coal fields, about the same time as Jesse James, you got an organization composed of immigrant, Irish workers known as the Molly Maguires. Pinkerton solved this as well. How do they do it? They send in a guy whose name is actually McPherson, but goes by the name of McFarland, to impersonate an expatriate who's been driven out of Ireland by the British version of the Pinkerton agency and has taken refugee status among his exiled countrymen in the coal fields to infiltrate the Molly Maguires. Does so quite successfully, up to the position or the circle of the leadership, Black Jack Kehoe and so forth, okay, begins to propose things that the Mollies weren't doing. Response in kind, dynamite activities, blowing up mine shafts and ventilator systems, assassinations of foremen and so forth. Some of this was acted upon, some of it was not, but ultimately he is persuasive enough and able to somehow mysteriously acquire the ordinance necessary to carry out these activities so that there's a major action planned. And guess what? Just as they show up to set the dynamite charges at the mine shaft, Pinkerton's police, mine police, private personnel, all manner of so-called law enforcement personnel are sitting there waiting in ambush. And you end up with 38 members, if I remember right, of the leadership of the Marty McGuire's going to the gallows. The mine owner was the judge in the court. Okay? But the point there is you got a provocateur, not just an infiltrator. An infiltrator will go in and feed back information, sensitive information, critical intelligence information. A provocateur will go in to disrupt, mislead, or do things in an active fashion to destroy the organization from the inside. And this is a classic sort of provocateur entrapment scenario that is worked out in the 1880s. Okay, let's carry that up into the 20th century. Late 1960s in New England, you got a guy by the name of Tommy Tagne, who was driving around in a recycled bread truck, painted with flower power, boom power to the Weather Nation and all that. He's a hyper-militant individual who goes from campus to campus trying to convince the local SDS chapters to bomb the ROTC buildings there. I'm not going to pass judgment one way or another on whether it's an effective tactic to bomb the ROTC buildings, but the point of the matter is that this guy is working both for the criminal intelligence divisions of the state investigative agencies in each of the New England states and the FBI. And every time you've got an attempt to bomb an ROTC building, the leadership cadre of the local SDS chapter ends up facing criminal conspiracy charges. So the techniques are worked out in the 19th century in terms of counterintelligence. What is counterintelligence actually? Well, counterintelligence has nothing at all to do with law enforcement. It has to do with, according to one of the people who puts COINTELPRO, and we'll come to that, one of the architects of COINTELPRO puts it this way, it has nothing to do with acquiring intelligence information for purposes of bringing charges and prosecutions and penalties. It has to do with neutralizing target. If you affect a neutralization of the target, it means the target can no longer do whatever it was that caused the targeting to occur in the first place, and you have a successful operation. Counterintelligence normally applies in the venue, and by charter applies for the FBI in the venue of the agents or representatives of hostile foreign powers. Now, you can include friendly foreign powers in there as well, but it has to do with things like espionage, sabotage, and so forth. You take out foreign nationals who are acting inside the borders of the United States in a clandestine fashion against the interests of the United States by bombing factories or sending disinformation or whatever, you eliminate their capacity to do that. It's not within a legal framework. Constitutional rights and guarantees do not apply. Those are totally suspended. These are people who are acting under the Espionage Act and under international law in a capacity that means that they can be summarily executed if apprehended in the process. That's the framework of understanding in which counterintelligence operations occur. It's something by legal definition, which is not applicable to the citizenry of the United States in pursuit of their political ideals, visions, or whatever. It's not really until, as was indicated in the introduction, 1956, that there is a formal inception of a counterintelligence program nationwide basis by the FBI, which is directed at the citizenry of the United States. But the precursors that we're talking about figure into the Bureau of Investigation and the FBI as a continuation of what the Pinkerton Agency has been doing right from day one. And day one really becomes 1912. It's 1912. It's when they, for the first time, create an investigative entity within the Justice Department itself. Well, sort of. It is a Justice Department operation, but now who's going to be qualified to staff it? And the answer to that, obviously, is Pinkerton personnel. So they simply change the designator on their paychecks from being the supposedly private sector entity, the Pinkertons, to being the government of the United States itself. But the linkages couldn't be more clear. It's exactly the same people. They just come onto the government payroll. And you start to see other patterns that are continued throughout the 20th century at that point. Selective prosecution, things which are technically an abridgment of federal law, because that's what it is they're mandated to do, to investigate suspected abridgments, violations of federal law. And there's a long list of things. They got about 9 people staffing-wise at the outset, but they got this list that goes on for pages of laws and violations thereof that they're supposed to investigate. In a way, I suppose you could say, practically speaking, there was no possibility that they could get to all of it, so they have to be selective in some sense, but the nature of the selectivity is very instructive. You have something, the Mann Act, for example, otherwise known as the White Slave Act, which is a federal law that was written in order to curtail interstate organization of prostitution. And the way the law reads is that anyone who, knowing consort, takes an unmarried female below the age of 21 across state lines can be charged under provision of the Mann Act. That's revised ultimately to read any female to whom you're not married. If you're a male, you take across, transport across state lines, you're subject to prosecution. Now, by and large, there are no prosecutions under the Mann Act. This is geared towards Diamond Jim Colosimo and the people in the Levy District of Chicago in particular, but also areas in New York City and New Orleans and so on. No prosecutions, no investigations that you can find records of occurring with regards to organized prostitution. What they do, the first and most notorious case of application of the Mann Act is against a guy by the name of Jack Johnson. Anybody know who that is? Yeah, world heavyweight champion boxer, happens to be black, which is absolutely, at this point in the evolution of American enlightenment, a no-no. See, white guys are not just intellectually superior in the early part of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, they're superior in every way, which includes physically. Now, they've gotten over that, okay? But at the time, a black man is not supposed to be able to beat up the world champion white boxer. And Johnson not only did, but he made a joke of it. And then he asked him to bring in 2 and 3 at a time, and he made a joke of that as well. They couldn't beat him up in the ring. So they charged him with traveling to Wisconsin from Chicago with his fiancée, who, horror of horrors, was a white woman, and ran him out of the country, destroyed his title, and so forth. All right. Technically, there was a violation, but a selective prosecution for an obviously political interest, and it's to do what it is that the FBI as a totality is designed to do. The best case you can put on all of this, that the FBI really has nothing to do with the law part of law enforcement. It has everything to do with the enforcement, and what it is that it's intended to enforce is the order of things as they're encountered. There is a place for everyone. There's a place for everything in this social hierarchy, and their job is to make sure that everyone and everything stays in that place so the system functions as it's intended to function by the people who design it and benefit most from it. That's their job. So the liberal critique that the FBI gets derailed, loses its sense of focus when it does these kinds of things, that it engages in excesses and so forth, that you need guidelines to curtail its activities within certain parameters, misses the point entirely. And the point is that it's designed to do exactly what it does. Exactly how it goes about doing it is to some extent irrelevant. It's the mission of the institution itself, which we have to understand and oppose. But let's go back to how they've gone about it, and the implications of how they've gone about it. You really see the surge in the FBI, which is still at that time known as the BOI, along about the time of World War I. And you got 3 major things which will resonate in the consciousness of stuff that happens in the 60s and 70s and the 80s that occur during World War I. They pass the Espionage Act, they pass an Alien Act. Under wartime conditions, need to tighten up, get everybody a little more disciplined. We're actually at war. We're getting ready to go at war. Whatever. And they say it's the hostile powers. Well, if you're neutral, you got no particular group of hostile nations out there, but The hostile powers are supposed to be Germany, Austria-Hungary, and so forth. The United States is aligned, even though it's ostensibly neutral with Great Britain. So they're saying they need to have the Espionage Act to combat German saboteurs and so forth. You actually have one incident, whether it was created by German saboteurs or not, I don't know. It's a little ambiguous. But you got the Black Tom Island explosion. That serves as a predication. Now, it's interesting here. There's this juxtaposition between the Espionage Act and the Alien Act. Basically, what they're saying is that anybody who would engage in espionage must be an alien. But the aliens they're concerned about don't happen, for the most part, to be Germans. They happen to be Southern Europeans. And they're Southern Europeans that they're concerned with. Well, partly because they're not quite white. All right, you got this influx of bad blood coming in the country. And there's a whole furor going on about that. But worse, they have these foreign ideologies and ideals, primarily anarchism. So the first thing they do, and it's kind of a test run, is something called the slacker raids. Now, this is instructive as well. They take people who are resisting universal conscription, the draft, in other words, and make them the primary target. Then they create this vigilante organization called the American Protective League, because you still don't have a whole lot of agents. So they need some horsepower. So they form this mass organization of American patriots, who incidentally mostly are of draft age, and then send them around in cities under FBI or Bureau of Investigation coordination from location to location, say saloon to saloon to pool hall to boarding house, to find males who are of draft age who do not have a selective service card. They ought to be in the Army. They at least got to be signed up for the draft. See, these guys who are self-evidently dodging the draft themselves, but from the right point of view, in service to the country, take people who might have the wrong ideas about why they wouldn't go into the military and fight in the trenches in France, and round them up and impose the compulsory conscription. Now, this is a vigilante organization, a right-wing organization of the first magnitude, becomes the amplitude of the FBI. That's its reach. That's its manpower. That's its horsepower. Coordinated. Private sector organization, but functioning in a de facto official capacity. It's like they've all been deputized, but there's no authorization to make such a deputization. Now, that's the warm-up. They do this on a nationwide basis. The contradictions are brought up in the press, but they're quelled quite easily. It's one thing to be a patriotic draft dodger like Dan Quayle. It's another thing to be a patriotic draft or an unpatriotic draft dodger, which means someone who's avoiding military service on principle. Principles are what's at issue. And they make that very clear, because the next round is something called the Palmer Raids. And the Palmer Raids are directed not at the saloons and pool halls, but at the immigrant halls, foreign language newspapers, boarding houses that cater to people that just came off the boat. And they round up 5,000 of them in a 50-city nationwide sweep in one night in early 1920. And then they sift them out. Now, you got things that sound like Chile after the overthrow of Allende that are occurring here. They got these people cooped up in basketball gymnasiums, no running water, one toilet for 500 people, old people, men, women, children alike, they're all foreigners. And you got these Bureau of Investigation agents who are sitting there screening them. What are they screening them for? They're screening them by name, okay? It's been compiled by a little clerk by the name of John Edgar Hoover, who's been hired to create a subversives list. And what they're screening them, how they arrived at whose names they wanted to detain, they cut the other people loose, is did they subscribe to an anarchist newspaper? Did they have relatives in the old country who were members of the anarchist movement? Was there somebody involved in socialist politics? Had somebody voted for Eugene Debs? All right. So they winnow that down ultimately to 500 people who were the key anarchists in this foreign constituency that they've identified on file work in Washington, D.C., and they put them all on a boat, USS Buford, in New York Harbor, and they send them to Russia. They're not from Russia, mind you. These guys were Italians and Bulgarians and, okay, but they send them to Russia. Why Russia? Because you've had the Bolshevik Revolution. They're all Reds, they're left-leaning, so what better place? Why send them back to Italy? Mess up Italy. Yeah. So that's how Emma Goldman ends up living in Moscow. All right? Emma Goldman's not Russian. Right? She never spent. She didn't speak Russian. She didn't even like Lenin, right? They sent her there anyway. Okay, next round after that is the IWW. This is the largest anarcho-syndicalist entity in the history of the United States. The one big union, the idea of the general strike, something that actually threatened the stability of the status quo. The idea was catching on. There's more than 1 million people went through the IWW during the course of its existence. It had the capacity to actually affect a transformation in industrial relations in this country, and it had a very strong rhetoric. I emphasize rhetoric. It defined things in terms of class warfare. And that rhetoric was turned around through the able administration of government propaganda to suggest that this was a violent organization. You look at the actual history of the American labor movement, you find something very interesting. Of all the major labor organizations at the turn of the century, the least violent of them all was the IWW. They worked on mass power. They didn't work on sabotage. They didn't work on assassinations and so forth. But they articulated a very radical view of how the relationships in the United States would have to be rearranged if there was to be social justice and economic justice and things like that. On the other hand, you got liberal organizations like the AFL. And the CIO, who didn't call for a radical transformation of relations, something more along the lines of simple equity, and they punctuated it with all kinds of labor violence, but they ultimately get sanctioned by the federal government as a representatives of the labor movement, the IWW, who had the idea of something far more constructive and progressive, was utterly obliterated. Ultimately, with the largest mass trial in the history of the United States, 101 IWW leaders in one courtroom in Chicago, Illinois, charged on sedition and so forth. They had a set of bleachers in a courtroom to hold the defendants. They were all convicted. So you got a decapitation, two-pronged, the roundup and summary deportation of the so-called foreign anarchist leadership, and the obliteration of the actual anarcho-syndicalist organization that happened in about a two-year period of time. Now, you got to stop for a second and ask yourself, what were the contours of the American labor movement? What were the consciousness of the American working class be in 2001 if in 1921 they hadn't totally destroyed a very viable, vibrant, and growing anarchist labor movement on the basis of what amounts to counterintelligence intervention? Okay, you got the repressive statutes, but you've also got the people who weren't roped into these mass trials, and the Chicago trial was simply the largest. It wasn't the only one. You had one in Sacramento of 40 people. You had one in Kansas of 36 people, and so on. The elimination of the leadership structure in toto. But key organizers in the field were simply being assassinated. Frank Little, for example, was made an example of by Pinkerton agents working in collaboration with a local Bureau of Investigation office in Montana, and was essentially lynched. No, there's nothing essentially about it. He was lynched, period, and left hanging on a railroad trestle as a warning to other radical organizers to get the hell out of the mining fields of Montana. And this was a throwback to the Reno operation that I didn't talk about in the 19th century. And finally, you got one other that I want to make from early 20th century as an example, a guy by the name of Marcus Garvey. Garvey, head of the United Negro Improvement Association, which to this day remains the largest mass movement, mass organization of African Americans in the history of the United States, who had a certain set of politics early in his life, but the time he gets UNIA on the board really would have been probably someone that the more conscious Republicans over in the Bush White House would have coveted as a leader for the black community now, because it was black self-sufficiency. Kind of a precursor to Farrakhan's rap. Business starts, community organizing, self-help, stuff like that. Blacks weren't supposed to self-help in those days. They were supposed to be utterly dependent, as in large part they remain today. But he was targeted on that basis. You got to be dependent. You got to be a surplus labor force to keep the cost of labor down among white workers who were the preferred workers. We need to take you out. How did they take him out? On a stock fraud thing. He was trying to start something called a Black Star Steamship Line. Put out an advertisement for investors. People invested Black Star at the particular moment. If I remember the specifics of the case correctly, Black Star at that moment did not need an infusion of capital, but they had other businesses in the constellation of things that UNEA was trying to get going that did need capital. No one ever accused Garvey of profiting from it. He simply put the investment for Black Star Line into another business and went to prison, maximum security in Atlanta, on a 10-year sentence, ultimately was deported. They let him out of prison on a quid pro quo. He'd never come back to the United States. UNEA collapses. But now there's something very interesting in this. You got an active investigation of Marcus Garvey that's undertaken in 1918. The conviction does not occur until 1924. The guy in charge of the investigation in 1918 is this file clerk by the name of John Edgar Hoover. And he writes this little letter at the end of his intensive field investigation of Marcus Garvey. He said, "We have done the investigation. We have scrutinized Garvey's activities extraordinarily closely, and, quote, unfortunately, end quote, we can find no violations of federal law. And therefore, I recommend the investigation continue. If we look at him long enough, we will find something. I'm confident." And ultimately they do, on this pretext. Now, this is a technical violation of law as well. Stock fraud, manipulation of the stock market. Can we think of another contemporaneous example of somebody manipulating the stock market? How about President of the United States, this revered, figure in American history, John F. Kennedy, his daddy, Joe, who took money off bootlegging with Dutch Schultz and gambling operations with Arnold Rothstein, funneled them into the stock market, had himself positioned so he could manipulate things in such a way that he had actual tangible impact in the stock market collapse of 1929. His punishment was to be drawn into the Treasury Department to write a set of laws to prevent anyone from doing what it was he'd just done. They let him keep the money, incidentally, which is how the Kennedys got rich. And he did that so well, outlawing his own activities, that they made him the first Irish ambassador to the court of St. James, just a little different than the experience of Marcus Garvey on the cheap, don't you think? I mean, there's about $10,000 involved in the Garvey case, none of it pocketed. There's about $30 million in personal profit involved in the Kennedy case, and you can see the difference in outcomes. So I do not need to hear arguments of a technical nature as to, well, you did break the law. Coming from an entity which violates its own constitutional requirement for equal justice before the law and is at odds with every single element of international law which is supposedly binding on its comportment, I don't need to hear about buckle your seatbelt. It's the law. Now, what would the face of the African-American community at the dawn of a new century look like if UNEA had not been neutralized as a matter of political expedience under the pretext of law by counterintelligence specialists of the Bureau of Investigation as a very, very high national priority? Labor movement, anarchist movement, black movement, these are major counters. And they're eliminating possibility every time this happens. People conceive a viable alternative to their assigned place in the order of things, and they set about creating that reality, and they're moving on it, and it's a very constructive and hopeful site, and then it's shattered, and penalties are visited. There's a message. There's a message there to the people who are involved in those things, and there's a message to their children. They're sending a message. They're sending a message. That's a term that they put out in the 1980s quite a lot. We're doing particular things we're doing not because they're necessary to do in their own right. We're overreacting, perhaps. But what we're trying to do is send a message to others by making examples. They're making examples of constructive things in order to maintain an extraordinarily repressive, regressive social order. The order that we all oppose. Well, the 1956 INSEP of COINTELPRO, it's a maintenance instrument, basically. We can talk about a whole proliferation of comparable antecedent arguments. But 56 is an interesting date when they start this up. It's on the tail end of the period that's somewhat erroneously known as McCarthyism. And basically what you've got at that point is an absolute obliteration of everything to the left of Attila the Hun and the entire social fabric of the United States. Okay? It would have made Frank Rizzo up in Philadelphia really, really proud. But the entire discourse, and 30 years later, you still see the ramifications of what they did to the conceptual understandings, the possibility of conceiving alternatives in the United States. And what it is that happens 30, actually 20 years later, is they start a little program on CNN. Some of you may have seen it. It's called Crossfire. That's where the left and the right engage one another. Yeah, it's a joke now, but you should have seen it in the beginning. They had on the right Bob Novak. Okay, this is truth in advertising. This is truly way right. I mean, Heinrich Himmler would be embarrassed with some of this stuff. Yeah, the right is ably represented here, and on the left you have Tom Braden, whose main pedigree is having been CIA station chief in Italy in the immediate post-World War II environment to subvert the Italian elections to prevent the Italian communists from gaining seats by the electoral process. That's the left. And so you got something that would be fascistically right-wing as the left, and then you got something way, way to the right of that. And that's the political discourse in the United States. And you wonder how people get so screwed up in their perceptions of things, and they're actually peddling this as being a left-right debate. This didn't happen by accident. In the context of the U.S. political discourse at the time, that actually is a left-right juxtaposition. This country is so far to the right that it really would make the Third Reich kind of shudder. They hadn't conceived these politics. This has not got to do with the racial content. It's got to do with the politics themselves. You have Nazis further to the left than the average American political pundit, and that's a fact. Go check it out. Check the Strasser brothers and so forth. I'm not trying to redeem these guys. I'm just trying to point it out for purposes of comparison. And this did not happen because there's something congenital in the American body politic which drives people into right-wing postures from birth. It takes some engineering. We're talking about the process of engineering. This is the goal of this stuff. So what did they do with COINTELPRO? They set up a process by which they could maintain that repression of political consciousness on a permanent level without having to do public dog and pony shows like the show trials of the 1940s and 50s. And they used as a laboratory, if you will, something called the Communist Party to do it. Now, the Communist Party had been the main target of the McCarthyites, and they were doing it right out front in public and purging anyone from any position of influence in American life because not a membership or participation in the Communist Party, but any kind of association at all, even three and four steps removed. It was that deep a cut in the political involvement of Americans, the realm of permissibility that had been made. But you can't maintain that public profile forever, so they decided to maintain it that way in secret. They used the CP, which was moribund. It no longer really existed. It had been destroyed. They revived it. That was the bit about the jokes. They began to infiltrate FBI personnel in phenomenal numbers into the Communist Party, taking with them cash resources to create the appearance that there was an entity so that they could practice techniques of destroying and maintaining and subverting it. Infiltrate, take over the leadership, mislead it, badjack it. The bona fide cadres. You understand about badjacking? This is one of the most insidious techniques there is. Comes out of prisons. But they apply it in the broader social circumstance here. That's where they will infiltrate people, establish their credibility, and they use the credibility they've established as infiltrators, agents, provocateurs to discredit the legitimate activists within the organization. Is targeted, usually by making a case that they are the infiltrators and the cops. So you end up with all these scenarios where people are sitting there cop baiting one another to the point of paranoia and self-neutralization, and that's actually something they come out with in the late 1960s. with the SDS, with the Students for a Democratic Society, said the purpose of the operation was to convince the genuine activists that there was an agent behind every mailbox and in their bedroom with them. Two different memos juxtaposed create this paranoid condition, which would be in itself sufficient in many cases to prevent people from engaging in actual constructive political activity. They would be so absolutely unable to make a determination of who they could trust to work with. So it goes by cop baiting, it goes by rumor mongering, it goes by internal dissemination of disinformation. Well, they move from the Communist Party COINTELPRO, the incept date of which is 1956, to 1960, they take on the SWP as well. Now, that's a little Trotskyite organization, doing pretty much the same thing that they had done with the Communist Party. Communist Party ends up being 50% agent personnel. The SWP ends up being 30% agent personnel. And then they take on the Puerto Rican independence movement. They never really declared an incept date for that, but that's in 1960 as well. And you start to have these overlaps with the civil rights movement that's emerging in the South, SCLC, NAACP, and so forth, Robert Williams. And in particular, because initially the SWP is trying to collaborate, provide support to Williams' wing of the NAACP. They decide it's all a communist plot. Wouldn't have been too difficult for J. Edgar Hoover to arrive at this particular position. He's been FBI director since 1924. Okay, he's a rabid anti-communist and he's a rabid racist. Refers to Martin Luther King as being Burrhead. The Burrhead is the FBI code name for Martin Luther King. So the racial content and the sensibilities of the people who are doing this sort of thing really tend to speak for themselves. There was never a formal COINTELPRO declared against SCLC, although they engage in all of the activities of counterintelligence that they're developing with the CP and the SWP. Okay? There is no COINTELPRO under that nomenclature declared against the offshoots and the people who disagree, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Corps and so forth. You got disagreements. There's not a homogeneous block of organizations out there who are composed of different age groups or religious sensibilities that comprise the civil rights movement. They take them all under fire in various ways, okay? But they never declare under that cryptonym, which simply means counterintelligence program directed at domestic targets. They never really open case files on them under that particular rubric, but you find all the operational techniques in the files of what it is that they do do. What they, on the other hand, declare is a COINTELPRO against what they call white racist hate, white racist hate groups. There is a counterintelligence operation aimed at them. But you got to make a juxtaposition in order to understand how they work there. They will infiltrate, they will do the same things that they will do to us, to right-wingers or racists, in a whole lot of ways. But the intent was different. The outcome, what they intended to accomplish by it. What they were after with the CP was a laboratory experiment. What they were after was the SWP was to destroy the organization. What they're after, even though they're not declaring it a counterintelligence program per se, with regard to the various elements of the civil rights movement, is to destroy the organization. What they're after when they declare an open COINTELPRO in their internal documents with the Klan is to take over the Klan and use it as an instrumentality in the furtherance of their counterintelligence objectives, the other organizations. Now, here's how this works. The Klan, actually, in some of its dimensions in the South, there's always been a relationship with the government. In fact, the Klan has been the government in a number of instances in American history. It ran Indiana in the 1920s, for example. It ran Colorado in the 1920s. It ran New Jersey. This is not a Southern phenomenon specifically, although it has strength in the South. It's actually had more political success in the North than it has in the South. But in any event, you've got this clear interlock between Klan interests and government interests that runs like a current through 20th century American history. But you actually got some wild card players out there, particularly in Mississippi, with something called the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And they're not really coordinating what they're doing. with the federal government. And it becomes ultimately embarrassing. They killed 3 civil rights workers that everybody knows about. They killed 30 civil rights workers. That means 27 of them are people you've never heard of. 3 of them got famous. Why? Because 2 of them are well-connected Jewish boys from New York City, major Democratic funders, which meant that their families were connected to the coordinator of Democratic politics for the state of New York. And when Mickey Schwerner disappeared, the guy got on the phone to Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the president of the United States, said, this is absolutely unacceptable. What are you going to do about it? And what he did about it was give J. Edgar Hoover an ultimatum to resolve a murder case for the first time with regard to the repression of civil rights workers by the Klan, or he was going to send the Navy in to do it, which would have been embarrassing to Hoover. And so Hoover actually assigned a bunch of agent personnel. Top dog, top counterintelligence program personnel. William Sullivan ran the operation himself. That's the associate director of the FBI in charge of this sort of thing. And they went in about 3 weeks, fixed that problem. They didn't fix it the way you saw in Mississippi burning, through superior investigative work and all of that. They went in and they hired a Klansman and said, A, we will not prosecute you for complicity in the murder, and B, we'll pay you $30,000. All you got to do is first tell us where the bodies are, and then give us the evidence as to who did it so that we can have a successful conclusion to the case. So is your tax dollars at work? That's how long it took them, however. At any moment in that whole process of violence in the civil rights movement, the FBI could have rolled up the Klan like, I don't know, somebody's used toilet paper, I suppose. They had the option, and they proved it right there. But it goes beyond that. In his memoir, Sullivan says, by the fall of 64, this is 3 months after the Myburn killings occurred, we had control of the Mississippi Klan. The White Knights were under our control. We had 20% or more of their membership, including the top leadership positions. We ran the thing from there on. Okay? Now, you can almost see him beating his chest at how well he'd done, how effective his methods were. But 50 pages on in the book, he makes mention of between 1964 and 1969, there's 300-odd bombings by the Mississippi Klan in Mississippi. Now, if the FBI is 20% or more of the membership and they have all the top slots, who is it that did those 300 bombings and who was it that got bombed? And why didn't you hear about it? Because it wasn't a wild card operation. It was a federal operation. It was an FBI operation. The guy who ran the operation said so. If you actually read what it was that he said, take those two pieces and put them together. Okay, they were hitting the right targets. And what were the right targets? The targets were things that were fundamental to the civil rights movement, to the furtherance of black interests in the South. They were using the Klan. Their counterintelligence operation had been to take over the Klan, to use it as an instrumentality to repress the civil rights movement. We need to understand that as well. Black Panther Party, they do declare COINTELPRO. Black Panther Party is a very, how should we put it, very committed, very dedicated, very undeterrible organization that picks up on a lot of the Garveyan ideas. What is the Black Panther Party about? The Black Panther Party is about essentially black communities seceding from the order of things and establishing a self-sufficiency base of their own, so they can be in control of their own destiny. And that's why they're targeted. J. Edgar Hoover actually writes a memorandum in 1968 saying the most dangerous organization in the country, he's already said this at a press club conference, the most dangerous organization, the greatest threat to internal security of the United States is the Black Panther Party, which then numbers 500 people. Okay? Why? Well, he makes that clear in a subsequent memo. Because they're doing things like running a Breakfast for Children program, and he actually targets the feeding of school children before they go to school in the morning so that they'll have nutrient content, protein, and so forth, so they can do little things like think when they're in class, okay, as being a subversive activity, and makes it a number one priority target for elimination. Why? Because it self-sufficiency. Self-determination comes from self-sufficiency, and that disrupts the smooth ordering of things. Yeah, the Panther idea was an idea that would resonate with those 500 people were resonating with, by poll at the time, 100,000 people in the black community. And that's what it was that was dangerous. So it wasn't that they were killing cops. That was the packaging. And that's another end of the counterintelligence operation is the packaging. There's a continuum of operational techniques. And it begins with disinformation, and that has to do with the packaging. And anybody that reads anything about the Black Panther Party, at the time, contemporaneous stuff, or most of the post hoc historical assessments, will find the word violence associated with them. The violence-prone Black Panthers, who are getting shot to pieces for serving eggs to kids in the morning, for running community health clinics, for trying to do job placement services, for rehabilitating slum buildings, for trying to make slum lords accountable to the people who are enriching them, and so on and so on and so on, trying to really constructively transform the fabric of the community existence, are targeted as being violent or violence prone. And why? Because they're exercising their constitutional right to defend themselves by arms if they were attacked by arms by the people who were in fact attacking them by arms. Between 1967 and 1971, 28 members of the Black Panther Party were killed by police and affiliated agencies. There's not one dead cop that you can hang your hat on. The one conviction was Huey Newton, which was a manslaughter conviction, and that was overturned in court. There is not one dead cop. 28 dead Panthers, and I have never seen a description of the violence-prone police agencies that were repressing the Black Panther Party under coordination of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You got to understand. That the demonization, the packaging of organizations so that they will be repellent rather than attractive to the general sensibility of the American public is the first level of counterintelligence neutralization. The FBI has an entire stable, still to this day. They don't call it that anymore. You don't hear about it because it became embarrassing to hear about that information leaked out. They have what they call friendly or cooperating journalists. That means they'll write whatever the FBI tells them to write. In a lot of cases, they don't even write it. They have what they call a crime statistics division in the basement of the building. Those guys aren't dealing with crime statistics in any way at all. They're writing copy. And what you got is journalists out there with the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Washington Times and all the rest of these, LA Tribune and so forth, who habitually sign off copy that was written in the basement of the FBI building and put it out to you as news. Small wonder you're getting one point of view as a consensus viewpoint in the American media. That's good business, and they don't get attacked as a result. And they don't even have to work for a living. They just can go down to Joe Cocker's bar, okay, and watch C-SPAN, I suppose, ESPN, whatever it is they do, and get paid for it, and you get their copy, their byline, they get the awards. That's the first level. Second level is this infiltration, provocateur stuff, so that you're spreading disinformation person to person within the organization themselves in order to disrupt. If they can badjack at you, if they can get you discredited among your peers and neutralize your political effectiveness, if you are assessed by them as having some potential, they'll try to take you out that way. If they can't discredit you individually or organizationally in the media, they'll try to do it that way or some combination of the two. If that doesn't work, well, we got other techniques. Some of the techniques would include the creation of pseudo-gangs. That's the technique they picked up from a couple of British counterinsurgency, not counterintelligence, but counterinsurgency specialists by the name of Robin Everly and Frank Kitson. Okay? A pseudo-gang, that's an interesting use. I said they always call us gangs. It's basically to create a political organization out of whole cloth in order to foment an ideological dispute where none otherwise existed. And you got some classic examples of that. You got the most classic of all probably being Lyndon LaRouche having the National Council of Labor Caucuses back at the inception of the 70s announced itself as being the hegemonic force of the left and proceeded to go around and trash everybody else's meetings by throwing bricks at their heads. Turns out to have been a government operation the whole time. LaRouche at that time was a paid federal employee. Okay, so you get an inside organization, you get an outside organization, you also have actual ideological disputes between bona fide organizations, exacerbate these using infiltrators, using disinformation. I got a classic case in Southern California between the United Slaves and the Black Panther Party where the FBI sat down with a cartoon kit and released cartoons on behalf of both organizations defaming the leadership of the other. So they copied, for the Black Panther Party, they copied the style of Emory Douglas, who was the house artist of the Black Panther Party. He was a minister of culture, did the cartoons. You can find the back page of the Black Panther newspaper. They had an FBI artist sitting there copying his style, putting out things, calling Juan Coringa, the head of the United Slaves, a pork chop nigger. insulting and degrading, knowing full well this is a very volatile situation. And in the assessment of the FBI, as they put it, extremely violence-prone organizations. They wanted to fomate the animosity between the two groups and then, quote, let nature take its course. Nature took its course, ultimately, with a little more help from the FBI, with two infiltrators walking in to Campbell Hall on the UCLA campus on January 17th, 1969, and putting .357 caliber Magnum bullets in the head of John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, who were the two primary leaders of the L.A. chapter of the Black Panther Party at the time. Okay, the shooter is a guy who's never been apprehended, and he was support cast with a couple guys by the name of Steiner, all on the FBI payroll. The Steiners were actually apprehended and convicted and walked out of a maximum security prison as escapees in California 3 years after the fact. Okay? They took credit for that in the internal memoranda as a successful operation. Huggins and Carter are dead. No FBI guy or no one attributable to the FBI actually pulled the trigger. But they created the circumstance, or so they said, and that's a believable thing. So it works so well, we recommend we continue the operation. 2 months later, Sylvester Bell gets killed in San Diego. Same thing. The intelligence, counterintelligence operative in the LA office who orchestrated the cartoon campaign said, look, it worked again. There's all kinds of dis-ease, potential violence in the black community all throughout Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego, everywhere. And while we cannot take sole credit for this, it is attributable in large part to our counterintelligence initiatives. We recommend it be continued. Ultimately, in New Jersey, they're putting out a scorecard to try to antagonize membership of United Slaves there and get them into, quote, a shooting war with the Black Panther Party in the Northeast. It says, Panthers, zip us six.